member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has been instrumental in a foundation named after his late mother, the Lillian Jean Kaplan Foundation, which has funded the settler organization, the Temple Institute, which is working to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a Jewish temple. Kaplan was also on the board of the 92nd Street Y Cultural Center in New York, which canceled a talk by Dr. Izzeldin Aboulesh, who lost three family members to the Israeli military. Thomas Kaplan also funds the Rekanati Kaplan Intelligence Fellows, which trains figures from U.S. and Israeli intelligence. Another key donor who might have asserted influence over these cancellations is the billionaire Leslie Wexner. He funds the Wexner Israel Fellowship at the university as part of the Center for Public Leadership. The fellowship aims to provide Israel's next generation of public leaders with superlative training in public management and leadership development. Graduates of the program include Shin Bet Chief Ami Ayalon and four major generals, Yedidi Yayari, Shay Avital, Amos Yadlin, and Yohanan Locker, later Netanyahu's military secretary. In 2016, the Israeli regime listed the Wexner Foundation on a list of public sector reserve programs organized directly by the Israeli Prime Minister's office. The next figure at the Harvard Kennedy School with significant links to Israel is Eden Offer, who sits on the Dean's Executive Board alongside his wife. Shipping billionaire Eden Offer's companies are reported as being used by Israeli intelligence to transport agents through the Middle East in key assassinations. It is believed the Offer family ships were used to transport agents who killed Mahmoud al-Manhu, chief of logistics and weapons procurement for the military wing of Palestinian resistance group Hamas. Another key funder is Robert Belfer, who sits on the board of governors at Israeli lobby group, the American Jewish Committee. He also works closely with Israeli lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League. Another example of the pro-Israel bias that exists at Harvard Kennedy School is the addition of former Israeli military general Amos Yadlin, who also sits as the executive director of the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies, as a Harvard senior fellow lecturing students. There is clearly a high level of influence from Zionist lobbyists in key positions of Harvard University.
David, tell us a bit more about the Temple Institute and Thomas Kaplan, who's a key funder of Harvard, isn't he?
Yeah, so the Temple Institute, which we've covered in this show before, is an organization based in occupied Al-Quds in Jerusalem, which is dedicated to the demolition, you heard that correctly, the demolition of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the replacement of it by a Jewish temple as part of their notion that this will bring the Day of Reckoning a little bit closer. So it's an extreme settler organization, and it's supported by this guy Kaplan, who's a billionaire, one of the key funders of Harvard. And you can see the connections here. This is a connection we've found time and time again on this show. People who are funding pro-Israel stuff in the US or the UK or other Western European countries are also engaged directly in funding illegal settlement activity, which is directly involved and implicated in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
Mm. Well, Shahad then told us what she made of Amos Yadlin, the former head of Israeli military intelligence, being able to lecture at Harvard University.
This is literally another example of how we see, as Palestinians, our oppression being normalized on all platforms. Similar to this warmonger or even war criminal, and we see people like him always using places, our universities, the media, platforms like this in order to legitimate their crimes against the Palestinians.
David, I mean, you mentioned earlier in the one of your previous answers about Leslie Wexner. I mean, he not only seems to be key to Israeli government operations, but he was also linked to Epstein's role in the university, wasn't he?
Yeah, him and Epstein were mates, and they were involved in donating together. You can see there they one of the buildings. There are buildings named after all sorts of different Zionist donors in Harvard, just as there are in Oxford and Cambridge.
Sure.
Extraordinary, when you start to add them all up, the amount of them. And Wexner, of course, is Victoria's Secret, and you know there's an industry which is not unadjacent to the stuff which Epstein was supposed to have been getting up to with his Lolita Express and his private island and the trafficking of young girls and women to be sexually exploited for the production of compromise. So there's a clear set of a nexus here and an attempt to, in a way, to give a positive public image to that nexus by donation to one of the most prestigious universities, the most prestigious university in the US, which, of course, is Harvard. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on here.
I wonder whether you could say also a word or two about Idan Ofer. There seems to be quite a sinister element to that story. I mean, the guy's also active in London, isn't he?
So the Ofer family is the big shipping family, and as we heard in the film there, they were involved. It's been publicly noted now that they've been involved in allowing their ships to be used by Mossad for ops, including operations in Iran. So they were travelling to Iran, and there was stories about this. They're breaking the boycott of Iran. Mm. Well, actually, they were doing it at the behest of Mossad so they could transport their operatives to undertake assassinations and murders in Iran. I mean, that's the direct role there. But in terms of the Harvard connection, yes, there's a connection at Harvard, and there's the programs named after Ofer, just as there are in other places. For example, in the Interdisciplinary Centre in Herzliya in occupied Palestine, which is the only private university there and which reserves 20% of its places for elite military or intelligence personnel, there's an Ofer Centre there, Sami Ofer Centre, named after Aydin's dad, Sami Ofer. In London, there's a Sami Ofer building just near Regent's Park, which is part of the London Business School. So that the money is sprayed around all over the place as a means to launder the image of these people who are engaged effectively in terrorism.
Mm. Well, Shahad also gave us her thoughts on how she thinks the story is going to develop and whether we're likely to see more victories on the horizon.
The tide is changing, and I think Israel is probably helping us by electing even more and more extremist governments, although all governments systematically and firmly, left and right, have been unified when it comes to the domination and the occupation of the Palestinians. But what is happening recently in Palestine is definitely worrying. We count on the sumud of the Palestinian people and their continued existence and resistance in the face of the illegal occupier. And we count on all those people of conscience that are rising and seeing all these paradoxes that are around us.
And finally, David, I wonder whether you could tell us about this other funder, Robert Belfour.
Yes, there's a Belfour Centre at Harvard, which is kind of a think tank based at Harvard. And Belfour, again, a key Zionist funder. So you see a picture here of a really rather large number of very significant Zionist funders. We haven't listed all of them in this show, but the ones we've listed are already enough to show a very significant influence of Zionist money in the university in general and in the social sciences and social and political sciences in general. And, of course, if that means that someone at Harvard happens to produce some decent research, I'm sure the decent research could be published, unless, of course, it is in any way critical of Zionism or the Zionist entity. And that's how this works. You know, it's not even that people are necessarily totally censored, which, of course, does happen, but that if they did come up with anything decent, any decent piece of work which is critical of Israel, it would be stopped.
Mm. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. Thanks to our guests, Shahad Abu Salama, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. The revelations in today's programme are ignored by the corporate media, so please share the information we've provided today to help expose these nefarious practices. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
So again, the important topic of the spread of Islam from the early times of Islam, the advent of Islam up until now. Was it through victory or colonization, or is better to say the power of the sword? What does historical facts tell us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is a kind of a stereotype, widespread among some of the people who, non-Muslims who have studied about Islam. And that is the claim that Islam, Islam is the religion of sword, meaning that the religion which was spread in different countries through power, through force. And on the other hand, the same people who are mainly Christians, they claim that Christianity is the religion of mercy and compassion and so on and so forth. So first of all, I would like to mention that, if they claim that we have kind of an Islamic emperor in the history of mankind, so the same is true about Christianity. In some periods, in some times and era, in different places, we have some government in the name of Christianity.
Yes.
And then they killed a lot of innocent people, especially the Muslims when it comes to crusades. We know that, thousands of Muslims were innocently killed by the crusaders. But the point is that as Muslims, we do not attribute this to Christianity.
Yes.
So we need to distinguish between the acts done by the followers of the religion, and the true doctrines of that religion.
For example, Greek Empire or Roman Empire.
Exactly.
Or something, or Latin Empire or something
so
like that.
So my first point is that given that Islam was spread through force, if we suppose
yes.
that, of course, we do not agree with that.
Okay.
But now the question is that, was in accordance with the teachings of Islam or
yes.
no? It was the actions of some ignorant Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
These are two different scenarios here. So
yes.
we do the same regarding Christians. In many cases, what is done by Christian people are according to us as Muslims against the teachings of Jesus. So we shouldn't claim that this is Christianity. No, Christianity
yes.
is a divine religion.
And we know that at the very beginning of the religion of Islam, when it was established in Medina and Mecca, Prophet Muhammad, through the language of peace, you know, peace talks, peaceful coexistence, you know, spread Islam, even in his war with the unbelievers and the polytheists of the Mecca, there was no bloodshed. Opportunity was given even to the children, to the women, old men and women to leave the city. And then, you know, through peace and peace talks, everything was spread over there. But unfortunately, after the demise of Prophet Muhammad, tribal,
mm-hmm.
we could say supremacy, started in spreading Islam out of the borders of Arab Peninsula.
So before going to that period, after the post-Prophet era, because you refer to some of the wars at the time of Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, there are a couple of points to be mentioned here. Of course, in some cases, we have conflict, we have a fight between the Prophet and his enemies. But the point is that as Muslims, we believe in two types of jihad, initiative jihad and defensive one. And yes, we believe that, according to many scholars, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family had all the right to have both. For defensive war, it is crystal clear. But for initiative war, we have verses of the Quran in this regard as well. But now the question is that, although the Holy Prophet had all the right to have initiative war, to begin a war, but did it happen at all or not?
Yes.
Because according to many scholars, all the prophetic wars, all the wars which happened at the time of the Prophet were defensive. And I believe that this is, the true understanding of the history. First of all, let me also refer to another point. Unfortunately, the Muslim historians, when they want to count the wars of the Prophet, they somehow go to extreme. They exaggerate about the number of the Prophet's war. We know that we have two types of wars, ghazwas and sariyas.
Yes.
Ghazwa refers to a war in which the Holy Prophet took part in person, and the Sariya is the one that the Holy Prophet is absent. He sends some people.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. Now, the point is that in many cases, no conflict happens at all. Imagine, the Battle of Tabuk, for example. The Muslim army, they go to a place, and the army is not present at all. In today's terminology, it is not called a war. No conflict happened at all, but this is considered as one of the big ghazwas of the Prophet. Or for
is this inside the Arab Peninsula, isn't it?
Yeah.
When we are talking about the victory of Islam over other lands, is this true again?
I will come to that.
Yes.
But now the point is that because you refer to the time of the Prophet, I need to explain that when it comes to the number, because the people say that, the Holy Prophet had 70 wars, 80 wars, and it is only during 10 years in Medina, which means that each year about 8 wars, which means that every 2 months, for example, one war, so Islam is the religion of violence, but this is not true. The number of the wars, the ghazwas and sariyas, are not true based on today's standards and criteria. So, for example, the Holy Prophet sends two person in the sariya, only two person, two people, to a region. And first of all, in today's terminology, is it called a war if you send two people to fight another two people or a group of people? It's not a war. In many cases, especially in Sariyas, no conflict happens at all. The Holy Prophet sends some people.
Okay.
But they come to a kind of peace or reconciliation, or the enemy is not present. My point is that when it comes to the number of the prophetic wars, exaggerate about the number. When it comes to today's terminology and the standards, maybe we can conclude that the Holy Prophet had only three wars. A war with the polities, a war with Jews, and the third type with the Christians.
Okay.
And in all these cases, and in none of them, the Holy Prophet began the war.
Yes.
The war with the polities began from the Battle of Badr, and we know that they were the one who initiated the war.
Okay.
For the Jews, it was the Jews who broke their peace treaty with the Prophet, and then the Holy Prophet was forced to have a conflict in the case of Bani Qurayza. And of course, for example, Bani Qaynuqa, no real fight happened, but it is considered as one of the wars. And the same is true about Christians.
Okay.
So my point is that when it comes to the time of the Prophet, first of all, he according to this understanding, yes, and based on today's criteria, he had only three wars. Mm-hmm. And in all these cases, the enemy began, yes, the war, and the Holy Prophet only defended himself.
And we should not forget about the main goal that was set by Prophet Muhammad. Was it really, we can say, invitation to the religion of Islam and introducing something new to the world in order to reform a society, or no? In order to change the lifestyle of the people, act as if the Romans and the, we can say, Greeks were, mm-hmm, living, mm-hmm, and also spreading Islam through, as you said, fighting a battlefield in order to reach more wealth. You know, these are different,
exactly,
goals.
Exactly. And that's the point we can get from the time the Holy Prophet began sending letters to,
yes,
different rulers and
first,
kings of,
yes,
Islam. At that time, the Holy Prophet had the utmost power in, mm-hmm, the region. So while he's sending
letters, yes,
so he was absolutely able to just, have a kind of fight against all these countries and
defeat
them.
Nothing happens when, for example, the king of Iran, for example, tears apart.
That's the point.
The letters,
exactly,
of Prophet Muhammad not accepting the invitation, no war took,
yeah,
place.
Yeah, the Holy Prophet
time
was able,
yes,
to initiate a war again. And this is, I believe, rooted in the Noble Book of Quran.
Yes.
The verses,
okay,
of the Quran say that religion is a matter of faith,
yes,
and heart. You cannot force the people to believe in your religion.
So, how this path was deviated, Sheikh, after the demise of Prophet?
Yeah, but let me just share one or two,
okay,
verses, and then I will come,
okay,
to that. So, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, وَلَوْ شَاءَ رَبُّكَ لَآمَنَ مَنْ فِي الْأَرْضِ كُلُّهُمْ جَمِيعًا. Had your Lord wished, all those who are on earth would have believed. أَفَأَنْتَ تُكْرِهُ النَّاسِ حَتَّى يَكُونُوا مُؤْمِنِينَ. Would you then force people until they become faithful? Very, very explicitly, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you cannot force the people into the religion of Islam. And the very famous verse, chapter Baqarah 256, لَا إِكْرَاهَ فِي الدِّينِ. There is no compulsion in religion. And of course, when it comes to, for example, the rights of dhimmis, those people of the book who had,
yes,
kind of covenant with the Islamic government, the Holy Prophet mentioned that the one who bothers a dhimmi, it is as if he or she has bothered me. And many other instructions by the Prophet about good treatment regarding the dhimmis. Now, when it comes to what you mentioned, from the time after the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, as Shia, we believe that what was done by the first three caliphs is not in line with the Islamic teachings. So, and even I would like to go to another step.
Yes.
According to many Shia researchers, if these three caliphs did not attack some countries, maybe today we have more Muslims living on the earth. And maybe those wars, they were against the spread of Islam. Of course, I will come to this point that there are exaggeration and misunderstanding about these wars. So when it comes to the Arab attack to Persia at that time, we know that in most of the regions, Iranians, they welcomed the people of Persia, they welcomed the Muslim army.
Mm-hmm.
So there are exaggerations about the number of the people who are killed, which is not true, and so on and so forth.
Even in Qadisiyah attack?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay,
okay. In some cases, a number of Iranians,
yes,
were killed.
Yes.
And the people from Persia and the army from Persia. But there are unfortunately many exaggerations about that.
But all in all, do you accept that the method of spreading Islam after the demise of Prophet Muhammad at the time of the caliphs and the Umayyads was very much different from that of Prophet Muhammad, isn't it?
Sure.
Okay.
And as Shia, we are against that.
Mm-hmm.
We do not,
But still, you believe
that
there are so many exaggerations, for example.
That's another story. Yeah, the number of the people who are killed, how the wars were conducted by Muslims.
Okay.
We have...
So let's discuss them, inshallah, in our upcoming session,
sure,
of the program, because
and
we are
just,
done for this.
One last point, and then we'll continue the following session. As Shia, we believe that, as I mentioned, without these wars, maybe Islam could have been spread more, compared to the acts done by the caliphs. There are many examples for this. I will share in the following session. And the last one is that when Imam Ali alayhi salam is selected by the people to be the fourth caliph, of course, he's the true, the first successor of the Prophet, he stops attacking any country. And this is very meaningful for us as not only Shia, rather as the Muslims.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi. We will continue, inshallah, discussion on how the religion of Islam was spread after the demise of Prophet Muhammad, whether we can call it a real victory or colonization of other lands. It was very kind of you. Please. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, call of Islam page, and Allah, so God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fi al-jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa husayn wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayn wa hasan. Inna fi al-jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. For big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today, in our studio, we have with us our special guest, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Dear listeners, Professor Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University. I'm a research scholar over here in the Hafza Almi of Qom. And we have been discussing a series of, we went through a series of episodes with Professor Naqvi where we discussed the levels of Tarbiyah and most important topics of Tarbiyah Islamic upbringing with him. And today we are continuing some important topic with him. Professor, we had a very interesting question. Where a three-year-old was making some mistake and a mother was concerned about the future of the child, she was wondering if the child could repeat the mistake and not accept his mistakes in future. Well, we do have so many people around today who are even adults. They don't accept their mistakes, even if they are wrong at some place. where they should accept their mistakes. What do you think? What does go wrong in the upbringing that leads to this thing, that they do not accept their mistakes as they grow up?
Number one, they should be, when they observe their parents, they don't learn this from their parents. As I said, if we were, as parents, if we were giving them a good example of accepting each other's mistakes, even if we've not made a mistake, and as I mentioned before, if my wife feels offended, and it's not because of any wrong things that I've done, she feels offended by some action or my behavior, but it's not a wrong behavior. Even then, if I accept that, okay, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, let's forget it, then that is a way of showing my children that you can accept mistakes even if you have not committed them. I mean, just to appease a person who you love, or you can accept your mistakes even if they are not apparently your mistakes. So that's one thing, that we don't find good examples in our lives, especially from our parents, from our elderly people. All the time we're seeing each other blaming each other. This is one situation. Another situation is that maybe as a child, our parents, especially our mothers, were always defensive and trying to justify what we've done. So that
exactly. That's what most mothers do.
So one thing is that the mother scolds you, tells you off in front of others. That's something not good, especially for something which is very, very not a big mistake at all. And secondly, mothers start justifying the mistakes that we have made. For example,
so there are two factors basically behind the fact. Okay.
So that sometimes you find mothers scolding instead of telling the child to take care of the door which is in front of him or her when he's going to the other room, instead of taking care and hitting the
now
door.
Now if he strikes the door.
Instead of opening it properly, the door slams upon him and he's hurt about that by that. So the mother would start hitting the door, that the door was wrong in doing so, whereas the child carried out the mistake. Now, again, you're not supposed to scold him, or you're not supposed to tell him that it was not a good thing you did. You should have opened the door properly, for example. So we need to teach them what the right thing is. Yeah. That is important. But how we do it is very important. And certainly it's not good to always, reprimand them and to tell them off that, oh, you're making mistakes. No, tell them what the right thing is to do. Tell them what the right thing, what is the right thing to do and how it should be done properly. Show them, look, this is how you should open a door, instead of, bashing into it.
Kicking the door and bashing the door itself. Yes. All right. So it's actually, if your child is hurt by a door, for example, you don't have to bash the door. You have to actually teach your child how to take care when he's going in and out of the room, rather than bashing the door, because this way he's not going to accept mistakes. Here he thinks door was wrong, and in future he thinks others were wrong. Well, we're going to discuss more after a short break, so stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab. I'm with Professor Naqavi. And we were talking about the adults who don't accept their mistakes as they grow up, or the teens as they are in the late teens and they don't accept their mistakes. Where does upbringing go wrong? Professor Naqavi, the first thing you said is that mothers, either they have scolded a lot, or parents, both the parents, the father, the mother, or both of them have scolded the child so much for a mistake that he's not going to accept it any time in the future. Or the second thing, whenever your child was doing wrong, rather than teaching him, you were actually bashing this and that, even the non-living things, like we gave the example of a door. Well, that was about this question. Now we have another question. This is a lady who is 67 years old, and she wonders about her granddaughters who take less care of her job or who are actually more concerned about their clothes and their outlooks. Because she says, what I have learned throughout my age is that if time goes back and I had to rectify something, is not to spend so much money on how we look like, because others don't give a damn. But my granddaughters are actually doing the same thing, and even modesty is getting diminished day by day. So how do we help them?
So actually, you can't go back in time and change your behavior. So that's the issue. Basically, that is the reason why all this is happening. That the example they have seen all their lives was their mothers giving so much attention to their makeup and to their apparent features and their clothes and how they dress up, how they make up, how they even show off their ornaments and jewelry and all that. So it becomes a vicious cycle. Some sort of all the time we're looking as what others feel, how others feel about us, and how others should be. We want to show off in front of them. So our children would certainly learn the same thing. Now, of course, there comes a certain age in adolescence, especially girls. They want to, and boys even, they want to show off what they are.
They're more concerned about what others think of me.
Yes, and their own features are important. They really get
obsessed
with their own features. And they feel. They give excessive time to how they look, and how others would look up to them. So this is a situation which has to be tackled in a very sensitive manner. This form of expression of one's inner energy should be given other channels. I mean, the expression should not be just with one's own features or one's own expressions or clothing or apparently how we look. It can be transferred and channelized into other positive, constructive activities where we allow our children to express their innovation and their creativity.
Yeah.
And how they can, change things for the better, take care of others. So
right.
This is what they should be learning at school. They should be learning at home. For example, I may have mentioned this. There's a school principal that I know of. When I went to his home, there was a motorcycle, a bicycle, a smaller child was opening, tearing it down and building it up, or the motorcycle, or whatever, different gadgets. They were there in the house, in the garage, where the children were free to do whatever they liked.
They're
so they were
constructing things.
They were constructing and
using that ability, basically.
So
yeah.
This feeling of being able to express oneself, can we channelize into constructive things?
We'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, you were saying that constructive ideas should be put into, actually, we should be working upon the constructive part of our children before it becomes destructive.
One of the basic senses, or one of the dimensions of human nature, is aesthetics, beauty. Everyone is concerned with this. It's something which is intrinsic in our human nature. As we like knowledge, we are obsessed with knowledge. We want to acquire knowledge. In the same way, we like things which are beautiful.
Yeah.
So we are looking for beauty everywhere. So the sense of aesthetics is there in all human beings. And this sense has to be somehow coordinated with the sense of beauty which we have in the creations of Allah Almighty. This feeling of this obsession with beauty somehow should be synchronized with the beauty of the creation of the universe.
Yeah.
And to be able to replicate that in our lives. For example, just give me an example. When one paints something, makes a painting, or makes, for example, a drawing of something which is natural.
All right.
So there's a connection here being created between the natural beauty which is out there,
yeah,
and the beauty which is within us, to be able to create that thing which replicates that natural beauty.
All right. That's so beautiful.
So this is how we can somehow make our children interact with nature, the true beauty of the nature, which is a manifestation of God's power and will. So that is important, how we channelize that feeling of, you know, expressing yourself and showing yourself off. It can be made to be manifested in different activities which are pastimes or hobbies, which should become a part of our daily lives. And so today, unfortunately, taking care of these
materialistic apparent features.
I mean, if you're not giving them this opportunity, then they're going to be engaged with
the same passion somewhere else. Because if we contemplate about Surah Adiyat, Allah Subhanahu wa Taala says that in the contemplation of the surah, that He has kept some passion within us, but He wants us to use that passion to move towards Him. But we are moving, actually running, like the fast running horses who are running in their races towards the dunya, towards the other things. And then He says, "Inna al-insana li rabbihi lakanud." Indeed, the humankind is so ungrateful towards their God, because the passion that was supposed to take us towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is actually taking us away, far away from Him, because we have used the same passion against Him, not towards Him. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the Ukraine conflict with analyst Mark Sloboda. But first, this brief analysis.
In recent weeks, we've witnessed some of the heaviest fighting in Ukraine since the beginning of the war, with Ukrainian and Western officials describing the loss of life on the Ukrainian side as massive and the loss of life on the Russian side as significant. Gone is the propaganda of previous months in the Western media about so-called Ukrainian strategic victories happening every day, replaced by a strained silence in the Western media about what is happening militarily on the ground. Instead, we are witnessing a mad scramble by the US and NATO to send tanks and other military hardware to Ukraine from any country in the world that the US can put pressure on to do so, with some countries beginning to complain about how this is leading to the depletion of their own military stocks and combat readiness. The attempt by the US and NATO to instrumentalize and mainstream a fringe neo-Nazi definition of Ukrainian nationalism and to weaponize this against Russia and culturally Russians in Ukraine seems to have failed miserably when considering the massive amount of military deaths, destruction of basic infrastructure, the almost 7 million Ukrainian refugees scattered around the globe, and the loss of Donbass and Crimea to Russia. There remains no doubt, even for Ukrainians, that Ukraine is literally being sacrificed for the sake of US hegemony in Europe. Meanwhile, Russia has not suffered the economic collapse, coup d'etat, or color revolution we were promised. On the contrary, it has seen its export revenues increase and its strategic relations with the increasingly powerful and wealthy non-Western world expand in depth and scope. Military experts warn that the heaviest fighting is yet to come, as Russia seems to be gathering forces for a major offensive in the near future. The outcome of the war in the next few months will have historic consequences for the future of global relations, and particularly for the future of Europe. A European future which looks bleak, as the US and NATO seem to be adding a further disaster to their list of disasters in the post-Cold War era. After the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, however, this time, the mass murder, physical destruction, war profiteering, and millions of refugees are not in a faraway Muslim land, but in the heart of Europe and Western civilization.
Mark Sloboda, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Mark, you've been writing about, talking about, going on television about the issue of this conflict in the Ukraine for many years now, before it even got to the point it is now. And it's very interesting because when you look at the Western media, at first it was very loud, and there was every day, there was, you know, every hour, every 10 minutes, there was some new story, some new development, but it's gotten very quiet. And that seems to be maybe based on the fact that it's not going the way that the propaganda had said that it would be going. So we want to talk today in our conversation a little bit about what's really happening on the ground, given the fact that it's really kind of obscure and there's no really good source that to hear what's really going on, particularly the English-speaking media. And then later, if you like, with your permission, we'll maybe talk a little bit about the geostrategic implications. What has happened now that we've been in this situation for this amount of time? You know, there have been some major geostrategic consequences. So if you could please update us on what's happening in the conflict today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on Insight. So yeah, I agree with you. It is, if you are just perusing the Western mainstream media, I think right now it is very difficult, if not impossible, to get an even halfway realistic idea of the state, even the nature of the conflict right now as it's occurring on the front lines in Ukraine. And it may seem quiet, but I assure you it is not. Right now, there is conflict basically entirely across the contact line, most of which right now is in the Donetsk region. And it is the most intense this conflict has been. The largest numbers of troops, the most intense. But I think you're also correct that the state of the conflict is not going the way that the Western propaganda narrative would like to spin it. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the regime in Kiev. And they have started clamping down very heavily, not only on their own now totally regime-controlled media, but also on the troops themselves, who in the very beginning of the conflict were regularly providing this type of mobile phone snapshots of what's going on there. So it is getting more difficult for that reason, although I think in the beginning of the conflict, that actually aided their propaganda narrative, you know, having this type of one-sided image. Meanwhile, the Russian military has very strongly, from the beginning, enforced a strict discipline, preventing the use of their troops. For one reason, as has become obvious, activating a mobile phone anywhere in the conflict zone allows you to be detected and targeted by enemy electronic warfare, radar systems, and the like. And it has there has been a very steep and very lethal learning curve to the idea that, maybe I shouldn't be carrying around this mobile phone and turning it on to text my family because it's going to get me and my brothers in arms killed very, very shortly. But I think you're also right that there are very big geostrategic implications. This is not just a conflict, of course, between Russia and Ukraine or Russia and the Kiev regime. It is not at the, even just a conflict between Russia and NATO, right? A proxy war in all nature. Right now, the future of the global order is being decided in Ukraine to a very large degree. You will hear all the time Western media talking about how actually the conflict in Ukraine is all about Taiwan. Because they try to draw parallels. But that's because there are very good parallels between what the West has done with Ukraine since geopolitically flipping it with the only West-backed putsch in 2014 and using it against Russia in a very same way they have been doing with Taiwan for decades now. And building to a crescendo. And it is all in line with the RAND Corporation's, very clearly iterated strategy known as the pressure cooker, where the goal is when you have a pure competitor or anyone who could potentially be a competitor to the U.S. hegemon, the goal is to surround it by hook or crook with proxy statelets that they can make sure that anti-Russian or anti-Chinese or anti-Iranian governments come to power in these countries, again, by hook or crook, and then they will weaponize those tensions and use those countries as vehicles of an aggressive U.S. foreign policy to contain and to continually destabilize those countries. So it's a very clearly iterated strategy. There's really, no questioning. You can say, is this what the U.S. is doing? Are they following RAND's strategy? And anyone who's familiar with it is pretty obvious that they are.
Right. So, Mark, we're going to get to that because, that's also something that we mention a lot on this program, the idea that what we see, these different conflicts that we see around the world are very much connected to a larger strategy that we might even go back further, was devised during the British Empire in terms of preventing some sort of Eurasian power or some sort of Eurasian unity from occurring. So we'll get to that. But I want to stay with this idea of, what's really happening on the ground today. We have statements by Ukrainian diplomats talking about massive, losses of life on their side, but obviously no numbers. We might never even know how much they lost. They might try to cover that up for years to come. So do we have an estimate of how much the Ukrainians are losing soldiers at the current situation that you were describing?
Sure. Again, numbers are something that is a propaganda point for both sides,
right?
Right? Russia talks about Ukrainian casualties. They don't talk about their own.
Right.
Ukraine.
So let us talk about both.
Right now, the center of the conflict is the Donetsk region.
Right.
Initially, Russia undertook what they call the special military operation, SMO, call it an intervention to understand the way the U.S. refers to there, in the Ukrainian civil conflict, which had already been occurring for 8 years. They did this with a very initially extremely limited military force, only 150,000 troops, buttressed by some 40 to 50,000 former East Ukrainians from the Donbass who have long been fighting against the regime that seized power in Kiev in 2000.
Mark, sorry, so we clarify for those of our audience who might not be familiar with the history. I mean, it's very difficult, but there might be some who don't know. The eastern regions in the Ukraine are Russian language, Russian culturally Russian. If you could just very briefly give us that quick introduction into how is it that they were fighting with the Russians or sought the help of the Russians and how that came about.
Sure. So Ukraine is a country with a very divided national identity conception.
Right.
And you can really view that as almost a geographic east-west divide. Of course, it's not 100%, but it's a good rule to go by.
Right.
And particularly in East Ukraine, in the very east of Ukraine, the Donbass regions, the majority of the population is Russian ethnic.
Right.
And everyone is Russian speaking. And you have to understand that prior to 2014, over half of Ukrainians spoke Russian at home on a daily basis,
right,
across the whole country, and pretty much everyone in the Donbass region. As a total, Ukraine has a total of about 20% of the population that identifies as ethnic Russian.
Right.
But on top of that, you have a substantial number of others, particularly in the east of the country, that see themselves as Russians and Ukrainians as brother people.
Right.
They have family on both sides of the border. It's not even easy often to differentiate between whether someone is Russian or Ukrainian.
Right.
My own family, my wife, full disclosure, is from the Crimea,
right,
and she comes from a mixed Russian-Ukrainian family,
right,
we have family all over East Ukraine, in Donbass, Kharkov, Odessa, and they identify with, if you want to say, the Russian world,
right,
but they didn't have a problem being Ukrainian citizens until the government that they had democratically elected was overthrown in 2014.
So Mark, let me just jump in here. So basically what you're saying is that when the putsch happened, this very extreme fringe version of Ukrainian identity, they tried to, in a way, force this kind of fringe identity that might have existed in the history of Ukraine onto all of the Ukraine, which didn't share that.
Exactly. So while in East Ukraine, they have this common brotherhood with Russians'
right,
identity conceptions, in West Ukraine, it's very, very different. For historical and cultural reasons, what is today West Ukraine, Galicia, historically, was not actually part of Ukraine or the Russian Empire or not even the Soviet Union up until just before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Before that, for centuries, it was separate. And the biggest part of their national identity conception is hatred of Russians.
Right.
That's the single biggest point. There are other there was hatred of Poles, hatred of Jews, hatred of other things. But first and foremost, hatred of Russians and I think you could say leftists as well. The whole project since 2014 to permanently geopolitically sever Russia and Ukraine has been to elevate this, the national identity conception of this West Ukrainian ultranationalism, over the rest of the country. And when you're dealing with a country that has a 20% ethnic Russian population,
right,
and if half the country speaking Russian, you can see where this would cause internal problems. And it has, right, long